welcome to A Galaxy Not So Far Away, a Mysterious Galaxy podcast. I'm Becca.
And I'm Gary.
And today we have the pleasure of having, you might know her from Reading Glasses on Maximum Fun. You might know her from her amazing book, The Woman from the Black Lagoon. We have Mallory O'Mara with us.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. And thank you for pronouncing my last name correctly.
Absolutely. It's the perks of actually knowing you in real life.
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of people, as a white girl, I shouldn't have anything to complain about, but most of the time people pronounce my last name wrong, and I'm like, no.
Today, guys, we are going to be discussing, I kind of just like threw out like LGBT plus people and women in horror, but really, I mean, it just boils down to we're talking about anyone that's not a cishet white man making horror.
I am so excited.
I'm down for this.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, like right up front, horror's not really, I get scared very easily. So I'll go through periods where I'm like watching horror movies and reading horror stuff. And it gets condensed to like, here's a month where I'm just going to like watch a couple movies. It's usually October. Here's a month I'm going to watch some movies. And then the rest of the year, I'm like, okay.
Oh, I have, if I actually, during October, I let myself watch and read nothing but horror. But if I had my druthers, I would do that every single month of the year.
I don't know. I get super jumpy.
Mallory, I know that I've seen it written that you were, that you got into horror very early in your life. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. I have been almost a lifelong horror fan. I think my part of my love of horror comes from the fact that I'm a super anxious person, and there's something very enticing and attractive about being afraid of something that isn't real for me. Because I'm like, I think we've all had one of those moments where like, man, I would so rather deal with werewolves than deal with my taxes. So as someone who is, when I go to sleep at night, my brain is always racing about work and everything I could be stressed out about. And the experience of being afraid and of thinking about something that wasn't real is actually super cathartic for me. And I found that when I was a really young kid, the first time was when I watched Fantasia and saw the Night on Bald Mountain sequence. And I was like, oh my God, this is something totally different. This is something not for kids. This is something, it was the first time I had ever really thought about art after I had consumed it. You know, when you're a little kid, you're just sort of like a art goldfish, you know, you just, things go in and things go out. You don't really absorb them, or you're not really thinking about them. But seeing that monster made me think about it afterwards, even though I was afraid of it. And that feeling was so attractive that I fell in love with the genre.
I had a very similar experience. My sister was a traditional goth when I was growing up, and her best friend in our neighborhood, I mean, her entire room, the ceiling, the floor, the walls, it was just Marilyn Manson posters. And, incredible. So they were very, very goth. And, you know, my parents like had me in ballet and very much wanted me to be this very stereotypical feminine girl archetype. But, like, there was something so enticing to me about all of this stuff that was the exact opposite of that. And I loved being scared from an early age. Like, I don't like roller coasters. I don't like scary, like, rides or real life situations. But I think horror is just, like, it's, like, that perfect, like, I feel safe and secure because I'm watching it happen to someone else. And I know it's not real.
Yes, for sure.
I have a hard time separating my brain from that. Like, I know objectively it's not real, but, like, my body doesn't seem to understand that. And so I still have that, like, nervous energy, and I don't know how to turn it off afterwards.
Oh, that's interesting, because for me, being an anxious person is sort of like constantly being stuck on like the second step of the stress cycle, and you can't complete it.
Yeah.
So when I watch a horror movie, and depending on the movie, of course, or book, and depending on the ending, those stories take me through the entire cycle. You know, being anxious is the fear of the future. You know, when you're, you know, it hasn't happened yet, so you can't grapple with it. But when you watch horror or you read it, you get to grapple with it because it's there. And by the end of it, I get to feel that catharsis, and I am so hooked on it.
I guess for me, it really depends on like how it ends. Cause even if the movie has that, like, cathartic relief, it's still, depending on how the movie ends, it can still sit with me. I go to bed and I have, like, the, oh my god, what if I'm next, or whatever. Like, I know it's not real, but
I can empathize for whatever reason with that,
my brain chemistry is telling me it is.
Horror that's, like, based on, that's, like, very close to, like, things that could actually happen to you, like that movie The Strangers, like Home Invasion,
yes,
Hush, like those types of films.
Hush was great, but
they
also
scared the hell out of me, because I can totally see that happening to me. And so, like, I feel like there's a very different feeling that invokes than, say, like, watching, like, Bride of Frankenstein or...
Sure.
Or even Creature of the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, for sure.
Horror has, like, different kinds of subgenres. Like, do you find that there are certain things that you like to gravitate towards?
Yeah, I am not a person who likes a... I depending on the director and the film and the writer, I will watch a slasher, I will watch a home invasion, but generally I really gravitate towards more supernatural things, like monsters. I'm a big haunted house fan. Anything with haunted houses or werewolves are, like, my two favorite things, because those things aren't real. Like Becca said, it's not cathartic for me to watch a movie like The Strangers, because that's something that could happen to me. So I'm not, like, getting that it doesn't feel soothing at the end. I'm just like, oh yeah, that's something. I'm a woman, like, this could happen to me anytime.
On the subject of horror, that, you know, your favorite, like, subgenres, do you have a particular, like, book or film that you would say is your favorite? Like, one that you go back to a lot, or one that you think really, like, sums up
your... I have tons.
Your...
to pick a favorite, you'd have to give me a subgenre. I have a whole separate pantheon of werewolf movies. I have a whole separate pantheon of, like, non-werewolf movies. For horror books, I have a short list of horror books that I think are flawless. If I had to pick my favorite horror book of all time, it would have to be something by Shirley Jackson, who is the queen of my world. Oh, she's the greatest. And with films, I couldn't pick just one. It would have to be from a subgenre.
So yeah, for Shirley Jackson, when I entered college for the first time, I took just, like, a general English course, like, nothing special. And I walked in and my professor was a super duper hot goth cowboy. And from the beginning of the class,
that's a combination.
What is his name?
I wish I could remember. If you hear me, Professor, whatever your name was, find me. I still think of you. But he basically told us from the get-go, he was like, I'm going to use this basic English class to sort of discuss the genre of horror and dissect the way that, like, women have been treated in it, depicted in it, and the women that have helped create it. And so we read The Lottery first, and that, it messed me up. I was like, how did I get to 19 as a horror fan and never hear the name Shirley Jackson?
She's
That's
the queen.
Wild.
Oh man, I am like, is this guy my dad? Like, am I here? Like, who is this man? I'm actually just picturing Orville Peck as at the front of your classroom talking about Shirley Jackson, which is probably what heaven looks like to me. A lot of people don't know about her. I mean, more people know about her now, but she, I think she is one of America's most important writers, but I wonder what is it about Shirley Jackson that makes, you know, her gives her a disadvantage against a lot of other classic American writers. Is it that she's a woman? Who could say?
What would give it away?
I mean, so weird. On the subject of amazing, talented female authors who, for some reason, are not talked about, Daphne du Maurier, who wrote Rebecca and the Birds. Two names that might be super familiar to any horror fans listening, because those are also two films that Alfred Hitchcock made, because he was influenced by Daphne's work, and she was basically, like, his horror muse. And, like, it got to the point where people were accusing her of writing books just to be made into films.
That's hysterical. As if, you get it, girl.
Because it's like, if, yeah, if, like,
good for
a
you.
Male author was being used for, like, filmmaking back in the day. Like, nobody would have been like, you're only writing for the money from the film rights. And it's like, maybe she was just a really talented writer, and Alfred Hitchcock wouldn't have turned out to be shit without her.
Yeah, there's, I mean, some of the most important horror writers we have, actually, I'd say at least half, if not most of the most important horror writers we have are women.
I mean, I think in both, like, books, comics, and film, like, women usually, like, I just feel like they approach horror in such a, like, refreshing way. I feel like a lot of male writers and directors sort of, like, use the same, like, formula over and over again and just change little things.
It's because women can't afford to be bad at things.
Yeah.
Any woman that is successful at anything has to be twice as good. So they have to be more original, they have to be more talented, they have to be more interesting, they have to be better.
Mallory, I know that you were a producer, if I'm not mistaken, yes, of a couple horror films, right?
Yes, I got my start in the genre industry as a producer for a small independent film company, and I worked for them for 7 years. And last year, I actually just went full time as a writer. But that's where my roots are, is in the genre film industry.
And it's incredible.
You know, I did want to ask, like, I know that you are obviously super duper busy with your, like, full time writing gig now, but do you ever, like, think about, like, going back and, like, maybe even, like, writing a horror?
Oh yeah, I mean, I've sold a horror screenplay before, and I have several that are just sort of kicking around that are, they're all horror, they're all female centric, they're all monster related. I definitely, I still love film. I'm still a huge cinephile. I love screenwriting. It's just something I'm not super focused on right now. And being a screenwriter is something that you have to do if you absolutely love it, and it is a tough industry. And book writing is what's my full-time job right now, and it is very labor intensive. I'm primarily a nonfiction writer, which is a lot of research, and it's a lot of time that goes into every book. So I just don't have a lot of extra time right now, but for sure, if depending on what my writing schedule looks like in the next few years, so if any other horror producers are listening to this, hit me up.
I mean, that totally makes sense what you're saying about how labor intensive it is. I mean, when I was reading Woman from the Black Lagoon for the first time, like, I could not believe how much information was packed into each chapter. Like, I did so much, like, side research based off of the book, because I was like, I want to know more about that. What is this place? I've never heard of this. And I mean, the work you put in is so evident in your writing.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I as a nonfiction writer, I have to constantly work against being a nerd, because I always want to put more things in there. But I have to work really hard to be like, nope, got to stay on task. Can't go on side tangents. Can't put on all these other things. Have to stick to the main story.
I wanted to talk a little bit about a little bit more about women that are screenplay writers and directors of horror.
I have a massive list for you. I have a big list. We are living in an embarrassment of riches of incredible women working in the horror industry right now. Last year, we had so many amazing. Actually, my favorite film of last year was a movie called The Wind, which was directed and written by Emma Tammy, and it's a flawless movie. There's also Gigi Salguerero, who wrote and directed Culture Shock, absolutely incredible border crossing film. Did either of you folks see Tigers Are Not Afraid by Issa Lopez?
No.
I've heard of that one. I hadn't heard of the first two, but I've heard good things about that one.
Tigers Are Not Afraid is a perfect film, written and directed by Issa Lopez. She's absolutely amazing. I saw on the outline that Becca, you wanted to talk about Raw, which is another amazing female-directed, female-written film by a French director, Julie Ducournau, and she is absolutely amazing. That film, awesome. Also, yeah, you know,
I wanted
we
to.
Loved her.
I was just going to say, I wanted to see, like, have you seen The Love Witch?
Yes, I have. Anna Biller's great. We also have Karen Kusama, who did Jennifer's Body. Her recent film, The Invitation, is absolutely incredible. She's the one who's redoing Dracula for the new rebooted
Blumhouse.
Yes, I heard about that.
Yeah, she's the Universal Monsterverse. Very excited about that. Also, well, in the world of women and LGBTQ films. There was an amazing movie last year called Riot Girls, written or directed by Jovanka Vukovic, who is a friend of mine, and she knocked that out of the park. It is so, so much fun. It is just like the gay post-apocalyptic high school movie of your dreams.
It's great.
Yeah, I absolutely loved that film.
And there's Satanic Panic. I did not know that you'd... Oh, yeah. Oh, Yvonne. Well, a lot of people in the horror scene, we all, ladies in the horror world, we all know each other.
I mean, that makes so much sense since it's like such a like, that's a woman doing horror and, you know, got to stick together. I actually ended up, when I was looking at my list of movies, because I didn't want to bring any that were like too obscure, but now I wish I had gone a little deeper. I ended up doing a lot of cross-examination of Raw and The Love Witch, because as I was like sort of thinking about them and the like themes used, I realized that both of them discuss like women in society and women's sexuality within the horror spectrum, but they do it so very differently.
Yes, that'd be a really interesting double feature. And I actually think that's something that's amazing about a lot of female-created horror films, is that sexuality is such an important and integral part of the horror genre. But because we have gotten it from this like cishet white male gaze for so long, we're so used to looking at women from that perspective that seeing it deconstructed from a female perspective is just... It sticks out because it's so different from what we're used to seeing, and it's so, so wonderful, and it's so fascinating.
Spoiler warning for anyone that hasn't seen Raw or The Love Witch. I'm going to be talking about some comparisons between them, so you might want to skip maybe like 30-ish seconds, maybe a minute. The scene in Raw where she is on the kitchen floor at that party, and they're like throwing like raw meat at her. Or, like, the scene where she, like, bites that guy. Like, oh my... I just, like, there was so much raw sexual energy to so much of her, like, cannibalistic awakening. And I was just like, this is, like, hot, but in a wrong way. Like...
Yes. I mean, I was floored by that film. I couldn't... It was just, like, one of those movies. I was like, I can't believe we're getting this kind of storytelling. Like, I give this woman all of the money. Please.
And it just, like, all of the work that went into The Love Witch, like, how much detail went into what film they use, the sound quality, the color spectrum. I mean, it's literally, like, two different universes because, you know, Raw has that very dull, very monotone, like, feeling of modern-day France, whereas, like, The Love Witch is so dreamy and hazy and everything kind of feels like you're under a spell. And, like, both of them, I walk away just feeling, like, absolutely confused. And I'm just like, I feel like I entered like another universe for that like couple of hours.
Yeah, it's amazing. Actually, if you read interviews with Anna Biller, who wrote and directed Love Witch, she was so, so involved with the production design of that film. And every single detail and every single scene was really, really well thought out by her. And her listening to her or reading her talk about it is very, very much worth your time if you watch the movie and really want to know more about it.
Oh, yeah. Also, Gary, I know that you literally just finished Jennifer's Body. What did you think of it?
You know, it's weird. I worked at the movie theater when this movie came out, and I remember having, like, I don't want to say, like, a weird relationship with it. I didn't really know anything about it other than Megan Fox was in it, and it... I don't know. Again, being someone who, like, doesn't consume horror on a very regular basis, it was something that, like, I could not have... if you had asked me, Becca, yesterday what that movie was about, I could not have told you. But it was fascinating. I definitely had a weird, like... I don't think I knew enough about it going in.
Did you like it?
I did. I enjoyed it. The thing that was weird for me was, like, I know that when I was, like, messaging you through it, the thing that was getting to me was, like, all the people that were in it that I didn't know about. But, by the second half, like after Jennifer's transformation, and then when you have that flashback sequence, I guess spoilers here now, for Jennifer's body, but after the flashback sequence where she's telling her friend Needy about, here's what happened to me, this is what these guys did, and this is why, like, I am the way I am, it's a tragedy, you know? Like, it kind of sucks. I love Needy at the end, like, being able to take the responsibility of going after these guys because of what they did to her friend.
Well, yeah, I think that that's, like, the thing that, like, I don't know how you feel about it, Mallory, but, like, I love that movie so much because I feel like teenage girls being interested in and wanting to exist within horror in a way that isn't, like, damaging to them is something that's considered, like, so taboo. Like, I used to always get shit as a female-bodied person being so into horror growing up and, like, liking, because, like, you know, I really like gore films and I like the, like, more messed up stuff. And, like, I felt like Jennifer's body was, like, a love note to, like, teenage girls to be like, hey, it's okay to like scary shit and it's okay to be, see yourself in horror. And, like,
I'm actually really, really happy that the film is getting a lot of love right now. I think it was the 20th anniversary or something like that last year, because when the film came out, 20th? It was marketed, yeah, something like that, or maybe 10th, I don't, time, who knows what time is anymore, but when the film came out, it was marketed as like, ooh, a sexy film about like sexy ladies, and it got totally torn to shreds at the box office.
Okay, because it is
of that.
10
That's
years.
Not what the movie is. And Karen Kusama had a hell of a fucking time getting her career back after that, even though the film is a masterpiece. It's a feminist masterpiece. The world just was not ready for it at the time. And the company that put it out marketed it in the complete wrong way. So I'm so stoked that it's getting mm-hmm. a lot of, it's being revisited and it's getting a lot of love.
And I feel like that film had the same thing happen to it that has happened to Megan Fox through her whole career, which is they were like, here's a hot woman.
Yep.
Tear her apart, society. And, like, I feel like nobody took her seriously in the role that she was in that film because they just were like, oh, well, she's just, like, the hot chick from Transformers or
she's
whatever.
Great. She's so good in it. And, yep. like, the attitude around it as, like, working at the theater when it was coming out was definitely that, like, I think people took it as a joke. Like, I don't know if I even had, like, people I worked with that really went out of their way to see it or, like, were telling people, hey, you should go watch this. Because all we knew is what we saw in the trailers, too, and I don't think that that did the movie any justice.
Yeah, for sure.
It's wild to, like, look back on it and be like, everybody was wrong about this film.
I mean,
yes,
I
yes, and now it's finally getting its day.
Yeah.
Obviously, the common thread that we're going to keep talking about over and over again until the end of this episode is women not being treated with the respect that they deserve in the horror genre.
100%.
I mean, like, I would say that most, your average Joe doesn't know that, like, Mary Harron is the director of American Psycho because that yeah. film does no. such a good job with the presentation of masculinity. And, like, it does have a lot of that more distasteful, like, approach to women in mm-hmm. horror. But, like, that has more to do with the source material, not the director. And, I mean, if anything, yeah. it just speaks to how talented Mary Harron is as a director.
Mary Harron made that book relevant. Bret Easton Ellis yeah. absolutely mm-hmm. hated the film adaptation of American Psycho and actually said that women shouldn't be directors because they're not as visually talented as men are.
I have never heard anyone talk about the book. It's exactly. always the movie.
Yes, because Mary Harron is the reason that story matters.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean,
what's really fascinating is, like, you know, when you get the one-offs that, like, do really blow up, because I remember when Babadook came out, it was huge.
Yes.
I think as soon as it hit Netflix and people were able to, like, watch it at home, it had, like, a whole second life of, like, people like me who don't watch horror went out of their way to watch it. And I don't know what it is about that movie that, like, gave it the life it had.
I know what it is. The LGBT...
I would love to hear it.
In my opinion, the LGBT community took that movie and were like, you know what? The Babadook is gay. And everyone was like, ha ha ha, whatever.
But
I mean, I just feel like...
What happened was Netflix accidentally miscategorized the Babadook as an LGBTQ film for a while. So it was, like, under LGBTQ the film category on Netflix. So somebody was like, oh, the Babadook is now a gay icon. And then it just kind of became a meme. Wow. And it completely took off.
I know that it had since become a meme, but I didn't realize that that was, like... the origin of its success.
I mean, for me personally, I didn't know anything about the film until it, like, blew up in the gay community on, like, Twitter. And I was like, I, like, watched it because I was like, wait, what the hell is this?
Well, it was huge in the horror community when it came out. It was just massive. Because, I mean, it got big in the film community just because it's a fucking fantastic... Sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear.
It's so good.
It's an absolutely fantastic film. It's just so, so well done. The performances are great. Everyone wants to murder that little child. But then I think that the world at large started to find out about the Babadook because of that. And it's a very memeable movie.
It is.
I mean, absolutely. I will say, too, like, a lot of the reason that I find that I'm late to the party on some of these, like, new films that are so popular in the horror community is because, like, you know, I started using the internet when I was, like, 9. So after about, like, age 15 or 16, I just kind of, like, left the horror community online because I was, like, tired of, like, creepy adult men who didn't understand boundaries and, like, people being shitty to me for being a teenager that liked horror. And so... Mallory, I feel like you're one of my, like, only, like, internet friends that, like, I actually can talk about horror with.
Oh, you gotta get back into it. It's filled with amazing people right now. Actually, most of my friends in the horror community online are women, they're gay, they're trans, they're people of color. Like, the community is absolutely... I mean, I do have a lot of guy friends, but the community is so vibrant and is so... But the internet has given the ability to a lot of, like, sub-communities in the horror world to, like, find each other and connect and to make more art and to make more media. There's some of the best horror podcasts right now are... there's the Queer Wolf podcast over at Fangoria, which is looks at horror films from a queer lens, which is absolutely amazing. It's my friend Michael Verratti's Bed for Filth, which is an amazing, amazing podcast. My friend Chelsea Stardust, who is also an incredible director. Her film last year, Satanic Panic, and All That We Destroy are both absolutely incredible. She has a new podcast over on Fangoria called Oh, the Horror of It All. There's just so much great stuff going on. So Becca, you got to come back.
I will say, I do have to apologize. I have to take it back. I also want to give a shout out to my friend Alex, who I've known, I mean, for a decade at this point. They also help run a horror podcast called The Horrible People's Podcast. It's on Apple and Spotify. It's absolutely fantastic. They just take and discuss different horror films. And on the subject of trans people in the horror community, I find myself so wanting of more LGBTQ-focused horror that isn't, like, weirdly homophobic or transphobic. Like, when you look up
trans... Oh, I got you covered. I have a whole list. I have a list right here ready for you.
Well, I was gonna say, because when you look up, like, trans horror, like, I was, like, you know, trying to come up with my list and think of, like, things I liked. Like, people were calling Sleepaway Camp, like, a must-see LGBT horror film. And I've never seen a film deal with, like, queer identity worse than that film. And it's just laughable. Like, Gary, like, okay, spoilers for this terrible movie.
Fine, go for it, please. I want to know.
At the very end, the character that you thought was a little girl the whole time and, like, ends up being the killer is a boy or something. Like, it's, like, basically, like, oh, like, everyone thought they were a little girl, but they're a little boy, and...
You should, instead of watching that, you should watch this film called The Rift. It came out 3 years ago. It's my favorite film of the year when it came out, directed by Erlinger Thordsen, and it is... It's like a gay Lost Highway. It is a flawless movie. It is called The Rift. It is, I'm pretty sure it's just on Amazon Prime and a bunch of other streaming services right now. It is so, 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 so good. I cannot stop talking about this movie. I would also, on the book front, one of my favorite authors ever, her name is Caitlin Kiernan. She's a woman in horror, but she's also trans, and she's just one of my favorite authors ever. The book, The Red Tree, is one of my favorites from her. It's the way that I I try to get people into her work. I think it's a great starting point, and it is so scary and so good.
Ooh, I'm so glad. I'm so excited.
Didn't they just put out like a best of her work recently?
Yes, Subterranean Press put out a best of a lot of her short stories.
Yeah, I have a copy of it, and I've read a couple of them, and they're great.
Oh, that's so exciting.
Also, definitely recommend, there's a film that came out last year called Cam, and I'm pretty sure it's on Netflix still. The director is a non-binary person, and the writer, Issa Mutsi, is absolutely incredible. They're such a great filmmaking team.
I actually did know about that one, because anytime there's a non-binary person in horror, my non-binary ass is like, ooh.
You're like, give me that shit.
Do you think the reason that, like, these communities, the queer communities or whoever, like, do you think the reason that, like, you find so many of them in the horror places, like, I think horror as a genre is one that traditionally in movie making, like, requires smaller budgets, you don't have a lot of the same sort of, like, not in a disparaging way, you don't have really the same production value that you find in, like, bigger films, and I think that it makes it more accessible for new creators to break into the scene anyway.
Well, that's definitely true for a lot of actors. Like,
why we see, yeah.
I think a lot of marginalized groups gravitate towards horror because horror is, they're the ones that horror happens to. They're the ones who have to deal with it in real life. You know, they're the ones who actually grapple with it. And so that's why I get really, I think that people from marginalized groups make the best kinds of horror because they're the ones who intimately know that feeling. And I think that a lot of horror creators gravitate towards the genre because it's a way for them to explore it and explore power and power dynamics and fear. And, you know, what more catharsis than being able to see somebody like you on screen fighting a monster that looks like the people who are after you in real life.
Well, and that's thing too, right? Like in my opinion, like, I don't think that the horror genre has legs to stand on without the queer community and without women. Like, for so long, the horror genre has used queer people and women as props and as things to, like, push storylines forward and character development and, like, use and abuse. And, like, so that's why I love seeing women direct horror and write horror and, like, queer people create horror, because it gives a new feeling to it. Like, you know, like, when I think of, like, John Waters, like, what he did with, like, Seed of Chucky is, like, amazing. I love that movie. It's so good.
Yeah, he's a national treasure.
Protect him at all costs. John Waters, if you're out there, I'm in love with you.
John Waters, I hope you're in a bunker. Please, stay safe. Yeah, we're just living in a really great time right now. It's sad right now with everything that's happening because of COVID-19, and there's a lot of films that are getting, whose release dates are getting delayed, especially, you know, in the horror community. There's a lot of films that we're all looking forward to that are probably going to get bumped out, big film festivals that are getting bumped out, but, you know, there's still amazing, so many amazing films that have already come out, so many books, so many comic creators. We're really living in a great time.
Oh, I know. On the subject of comic creators, I mean, I'm sure that you're familiar with Emily Carroll's work.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with Emily Carroll. And, you know, speaking of queer stuff, her latest, what is it, One Night at the Castle? Or We Came to the Castle, something like that.
Is it We Always Lived in the Castle? No, that's somebody else.
It's Shirley Jackson. It's
I was think, like...
It's something Emily, let me look it up right now. I'm trying to
When I arrived at the castle.
When I arrived at the castle. I knew it was something like that. Like, what, it's such a beautiful,
it's literally on my bookshelf.
It's so, 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 so good. It is such an incredible piece of art. It's such a cool story. Anything that she comes out with, I'm like, take my money, Emily Carroll.
Have you had the opportunity to play the Yogg?
No, when I saw that in the episode show notes, I got really intrigued. Do you know, what is it, what do you play it on?
Oh my god. Mallory, you and I are going to have a Google Hangout, because it's on the Steam
Teach
link.
Teach me this stuff.
Yes, we will get together and play it. Basically, it's a click-through, choose-your-own-adventure-slash-fate type of game. The Yogg is this, like, big catastrophe or big monster. You know, you can kind of look at it however you want, that happens to your town. And so basically the game, the premise is like, it's like the first, it's like the 5 days leading up to the Yogg. And each day you can go to one part of the village and choose to do one of two things. And like on the right hand of the screen is stats, and they're very similar to like D&D stats, the way they're categorized, like charisma and magic and stamina and things like that. And based on what you do, like your decisions you make in the game, you like can gain or lose different stats. And then at the end of the 5 days, the Yogg happens and it destroys your village. And then you get to choose your role in the rebuilding process. And based on how well or poorly you did leading up to that is how well or poorly you do in your efforts to help save the town. And in the end, it's either you do save the town or it's completely destroyed after the Yogg.
Oh, I am in. Is this a browser game, like on a computer?
No, it's on Steam. So it's on your computer. And literally, like, when we play it, you'll see it's basically like you hit the space bar and then you hit the enter bar and you go up or down and that's it.
Oh, nice.
And the art is absolutely gorgeous. The stories are so fun. Like, David, my partner, and I were playing it this weekend with some friends and still got new options, even though it was probably like our 20 plus time playing it.
Awesome.
I think you'll really like it.
I am in. Yeah, anything that Emily Carroll is involved with, you can count me in for sure.
Before we lose you, do you mind if we talk a little bit about some of your work, Mallory?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
I just want to say before we get into questions, congratulations on your Rondo Award for Book of the Year.
Oh, thank you so much.
For our listeners that don't know, it's basically like the Oscars of the horror genre. And also congratulations on your nomination for a Hugo Award for Best Related Work.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a big week. It's pretty exciting.
That's amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And so I'm going to ask, because I have to ask because I'm obsessed, tell us about your upcoming book, Girly Drinks, about women's history of making and drinking.
Yes. So the next book that I have coming out is by the same team, same editor, same publisher and everything who did Lady from the Black Lagoon. It is called Girly Drinks. It is the history of women making and drinking alcohol all over the world from when alcohol was invented until now. It is such a blast. It's exactly what it sounds like. The first chapter starts with when alcohol was discovered/invented, and it's just a history of how women have been the ones who have been intimately involved in alcohol culture from the very beginning, you know, from ancient Mesopotamia all the way up until now, whether it's being behind the bar or brewing or distilling or being the ones who drink. I found out that you can basically tell how free a woman is in any particular culture at any particular time period in any part of the world by whether or not she's allowed to drink. So it's been a really interesting way to examine a woman's history of the world. And I'm a huge cocktail nerd. I'm a huge alcohol nerd. So it's been such a dream. And my editor, Peter Joseph, who's a genius, is also a huge cocktail nerd and used to be a cocktail writer. So when he found out that I was working on this, he was like, oh yeah, we're doing
That's
this.
Really fun.
I just think it's insane. Like, you know, your last book was so chock full of, you know, research and historical facts and all this wonderful information. So I'm so excited to read Girly Drinks. I can't even fathom, like, how much research you're putting into this book.
I have honestly probably already read at least 200 books for it.
Amazing.
Oh, my God.
Was this something that you were, like, interested in researching, like, I'm sure this is something that you've been interested in before the book happened, but like how do you make that transition from like a passive interest to like, no, I'm actually doing research for this now?
So that's my life. I've been a cocktail nerd for a few years now, and whenever I get really into anything, I want to read about it. And
okay.
My best friend Lauren Pinapinto, who is the creative director over at Orbit Books, when she got me into cocktails, I said, "Hey, Lauren, you know, all these cocktail history books are great, but where are all the books about women and by women?" And she's like, "They don't really exist." And I was like, "Well, I know what I have to do now."
Yes. I guess this is, I will take on this challenge.
Yeah, so far my entire career, and it looks like for a few years at least, will be writing the books that I want to read.
That's amazing.
I do have to ask, as a fellow cocktail enthusiast, what is your go-to cocktail? Ooh.
My favorite cocktail actually is very simple. It's I love a classic daiquiri. It's a really great way to tell how good a bar is and what a bartender is like by how they make a daiquiri. I'm a huge rum person. And it's rum is one of those really interesting liquors because we all, when we're growing up in teenage years, we get this like horrible idea of what rum is when we drink Bacardi and we think of like shitty strawberry daiquiris at Applebee's or something. Yeah. But rum is actually like one of the most fascinating and historically complex and taste-wise complex liquors that you could drink. And I love it so much. But when it comes to just like drinking straight alcohol, which I do all the time, I am a bourbon person. I am a huge, huge, huge fan of bourbon. I love trying out new bourbons. Me and my partner, Jeremy Lambert, who's also a writer, we're constantly on the search for new bourbons and new scotches.
I love that. That's incredible. I'm really happy you said a very simple drink. I was worried it would be something very complex and intimidating. And I would just be like, well, I like Moscow mules.
No, I really think that the best way to get into cocktails and to showcase really good booze is with a simple drink with fresh ingredients. I mean, not that I don't like an extremely ridiculously complicated cocktail. One of the first things I do when we get out of quarantine is I'm going to a cocktail bar. But I love, love, love a daiquiri.
I am so excited about your book. I'm so excited that you were able to do this with us. For everybody that is looking for more info from Mallory, Mallory, do you want to give us your Twitter handle?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Mallory O'Mara. I'm on Twitter way more than I should be. All information about my books and my projects, my podcast is at just MalloryO'Mara.com. If you're interested in the book, it's available everywhere. Right now, I really, really ask you to try to get it from an independent bookseller like Mysterious Galaxy. I also narrate the audiobook if you are interested in if you're a big podcast person and you like listening to things, you can get that from Libro FM and donate to Mysterious Galaxy and choose Mysterious Galaxy as your bookstore. And part of the proceeds will go there. So there's a lot of different ways you can support this bookstore, and no matter how you want to either listen to or read this book.
We appreciate that so much.
Yes.
I appreciate you folks.
Oh.
I have one last question for you, Mallory.
Yep.
So as we close out the show, we like to talk about our TBR piles, our to be read. What are you reading right now, if you can tell us?
I'm actually reading the perfect book for this episode. It's called The Awesome by Eva Darrows, who is the pseudonym for a writer that I know and adore named Hilary Monahan. She is a total horror queen. She's absolutely amazing. Read anything she writes under any of her pseudonyms. But The Awesome is such a great, super fun. It's a YA horror book. It's about this teenage girl, and her mother are monster hunters by trade, and she's an apprentice for her mom. But she can't become a journeyman monster hunter until she loses her virginity, because vampires go, and a lot of other monsters go nuts when they smell virgin blood. So she's really frustrated that she has to take time out of her monster hunting life to try to find a boyfriend. It is so funny. It is so much
that
fun.
That sounds amazing.
It sounds so good.
It is a total blast. It's called The Awesome by Eva Darrows. I highly, 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 highly recommend it in anything else that Hilary Monahan does.
Amazing. We'll put links for that in the description on the episode, of course, so that people can go find this. Becca, what? You said my name. What?
What are you reading?
What am I? I am slowly inching my way closer to the end of Howling Dark by Chris Rocchio, which is the science fantasy I've been talking about for the last few episodes. And I just started Repo Virtual by, I should know this author's name off the top of my head and I don't, by Corey White, which may or may not be our fantastic first pick for next month. So I'm trying to finish that as quickly as possible so that we can announce that on social media and stuff. But it's been good so far. I'm really enjoying it. I've been on like a sci-fi kick, which is something that I don't do very often. I usually need more
fantasy. Yeah, I've noticed
that. Yeah. What about you? What are you reading, Becca?
also very appropriate to the subject, and I'm sad I didn't get to talk about her. I am reading the Bloodhound manga series. It's by a mangaka named Kaori Yuki. She did Godchild. She did Alice in Horrorland. She is a amazing romance gothic horror manga creator. I really love her work. I highly recommend it. The art is absolutely gorgeous. The stories are super insane and exciting. And yeah, it's all around a fun time. I've been reading her stuff since I was way too young to be reading her stuff.
That sounds amazing.
Yes. I will. I believe that you can buy copies through Mysterious Galaxy. So we will link that down below if possible. And as always, thank you so much to Mallory for being our guest. We really appreciate it, guys. Go pick
Thanks so up much for having me.
The Woman from the Black Lagoon.
Thanks for being here.
Yes, of course. And then, of course, you can listen to Reading Glasses on Maximum Fun.
Yes, if you want to hear me talk about more books, you can go check out the podcast that I do every week with my friend Bria Grant, who is also a woman in horror and an incredible horror director.
And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Myst Galaxy Books. Mm-hmm. Our website is mystgalaxy.com. And thank you to Austin Farmer. He is the musician behind the music for our opening and ending sound from the album Bookshelf Symphony Orchestra. You can find him on Spotify. Please do. The music is fantastic.
I'm such a fan. He's been coming to the store for so long. And has been trying to do stuff for the store for so long, so it's really great that we're able to, like, work with him.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah, all his, that whole album is inspired by various books, so we're using a piece of music from the Kill the Farm Boy track, but he's got a lot of other really fun ones as well. Yeah, it's great, it's so good! I really want people to go look that up, because every track is about a different book, and, like, the emotion inspired by it, and it's cool.
Awesome.
Alright guys, until next time, we'll see you again soon in a galaxy not so far away.